I hope and expect that some of you will have seen August Wilson's play called Two Trains Running that's on at the Finn Chandler at the Arena stage and is on for another week or so. It's a fantastic production. It's worthy of much thought and conversation. But I bring it up this morning because of one character. And it's a character who never appears on stage in this play, although I gather that she does in a later one of his. And her name is Aunt Esther. And Aunt Esther is an advice giver in the community in this little declining area of Pittsburgh in which the play is set. And some of the characters go and get advice to her. And what she really does is help them move from aspiration to action. She helps them go after what they really want. She helps them sort of read their own spirits and gives them courage to act. And then she does something. She refuses to take payment. We're told this over and over again. She refuses to accept payment, but says instead, go and throw $20 in the river, like $150 today. Go throw $20 in the river. And we wonder what that's about. It seems that Esther, Aunt Esther, is meant to sound a bit like ancestor. It's meant to be the advice of the ages for the community. And she's reportedly 349 years old. Which is roughly the time when the first slaves were appearing in North America. She lives, we're told over and over again, at 1839 Wiley Avenue. And I didn't get that one. I had to look that one up. But 1839 was the year that 53 African natives staged a rebellion on their Spanish slave ship headed to Cuba, and eventually they made it back to Africa. And so the role of this historically connected and eccentric woman is to help these onstage characters deal with their lives in declining Pittsburgh. Now, some of her advice is questionable, to be polite, but she refuses payment and asks them to throw money in the river. What's that about? Well, some people think maybe it's a sign of economic exploitation, or maybe it's a symbol of how hard it is for people in this community to hold on to or accumulate money, which is a big part of their conversation, the theme of the play. But I think it's also a demand that they not be half-hearted about following her advice and going after whatever it is that they want in life. Another theme of conversations in the play, that aspiration by itself is not enough to bring about change. Committed action is required if we want our aspirations to amount to anything. So the truth in the play is, of course, reflective of the life of faith at its best. There is no option to be slightly committed to following Jesus. You can't be a little bit baptized. If we aspire to receive the promise of the gospel, abundant life and forgiveness and hope and courage and fortitude and right relationship and justice and all the things that amount to the gospel promise, then we must be all in, doing the equivalent of throwing our $20 in the river. Like most of the characters in Two Trains Running, we all have plenty of ways of avoiding leading fully committed lives. Plenty of ways of sabotaging our own intentions and aspirations, undermining our own resolve. And in the life of faith, one of the most seductive tricks is to get all worked up about some very interesting theological question over which we can agonize for a long time in such a way as it makes sure we don't ever have to act. And one of these, you'll recognize, one of these is, what are we to make of the exclusive claims or exceptional claims attributed variously to Jesus and the apostles on behalf of the early church? Jesus is the stone that was rejected by you, the builders. It has become the cornerstone. There is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven by which we must be saved. No other name, no other way. Really? I mean, really? How are we going to deal with that? Well, it's easy enough to read these claims as part of how a group forms over against others. We say this is the particular way to distinguish ourselves from other ways. Maybe we can say that it was polemic as followers of what was then called the Way were being evicted from their synagogues. Maybe we can say it was an unfortunate and deathly rationale justifying centuries of anti-Semitism. Or maybe we could say, we just don't believe it, it's just wrong. gives us a little pause about what we make of the Bible if we go that route. We might think that we have more awareness of difference, religious difference, than was the case with the ancients, that we're more aware of varieties of religious experience and expression and so on. But the reality is the Roman and Greek world were filled with gods, all gods of all kinds, altars all over the place. Remember the story where Paul says, I know who the unknown god is at that altar over there. They had plenty of noise and religious claims and competing religious claims just as we do. But the early church was saying in the midst of all this noise, wait, listen, this is different. This is not just one more failed prophet, one more dead prophet, one more failed movement. This is something to which you need to pay attention. But then, like now, it was all too easy to dismiss yet another religious claim, to pity the deluded who need such crutches. Or, like August Wilson in his play, see some helpful aspects to religious and spiritual tradition for people trying to get on with their lives in dire circumstances, but recognize at the same time there's a real and ugly underbelly to the whole enterprise as well. And even if we are among those who recognize the importance of world religions in shaping our geopolitical realities, it can make it very difficult to choose one of these religious options over the others when we recognize that all of them have within them the seeds of peace and justice, and all of them have within them the seeds of violence and death and war. Why would we choose? In a way, that's a bit like the conversation that goes on these days in universities that have both religious studies departments and divinity schools. Even if the original purpose of the university was to be a school of committed faith, nowadays it makes sense to study religions, but does it make sense to have a school of commitment in the midst of a university as well? So what we know, is that really specific and particular religious commitment is the only way forward, shaping our lives toward what really matters, that we may in turn be shaped by what really matters, and so receive the promises of the gospel really and truly in our own lives and experience. So I deal with the exclusivist scriptures, not by being poleaxed so I can't make a decision, can't make a choice, but instead hearing them as an absolute existential claim on my own life, without making any judgments about apparently completing claims on the lives of others. For me, for a host of religious and historic and cultural and circumstantial reasons, there is no other name under heaven by which I will be saved. And so I do and will bear witness to that truth in my own life. And I do and will invite anyone to join me. But all the while, I'm clear that any heart changing that's going on is God's work. Not ours, not the church's. It's God who changes hearts and opens our eyes and ears to the possibility of abundant life when we commit to the particular way, the way that is following Jesus, the way as disciples of Jesus. Our job is to bear witness to the good news being made real in our lives. Our job is not to convert others. Our job is to tell the story and to tell why it matters to us. And we do this in part alongside a good shepherd. The good shepherd who went before us in this way, fully committed to trusting God for life. Not half committed, trusting God for life even unto death. The hired hand neither owns the sheep nor really cares for them. The half-hearted shepherd, if you like, runs away at the first sign of trouble when the wolf comes. Not so the good shepherd. The good shepherd is the one who has not only shown the way, but in some sense made the way of life possible for us. The good shepherd is trustworthy to make us lie down in green pastures, to revive our souls, to guide us along right pathways. And the good shepherd can do all these things, perhaps, because the good shepherd can accompany us through the valley of the shadow of death, because we know that he has gone before in the green pastures of Gethsemane, perhaps, that story overshadowed by his own impending death. His prayer, is there some other way? His conclusion that the worst thing in life is not death. The worst thing in life is breaking faith with the source of his life, that is love. The worst thing in life is not allowing is not death as a horizon. The worst thing in life is assuming that death is the horizon and not trusting in the source of life for love and life and meaning and purpose and hope. The Good Shepherd is the trustworthy one who spreads a table before us and invites us into the feast of abundant life forever. So August Wilson's play is about getting on with life in the shadow of the deaths of both Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. It's about the search for love and relationship and meaning in the face of death. Critical of religious self, but perhaps points to the transformative power bound up with living a committed life. Throw your $20 in the river. But the gospel goes further than that. The gospel invites us to hear the invitation to life as an exclusive claim on our hearts, for it is the way and the truth and the life for those with ears to hear. So in our customary time of silence, you might reflect on how you are living out your own commitment to following Jesus. And if there are places where you find yourselves compromised by circumstance, by life, happens to all of us at some point or another, know that, and know that it's never too late to hear again the call and recommit to life. Throw your $20 in the river. No aspiration without action. Live the committed life, practice the faith, and find the Good Shepherd trustworthy all your days. In silence and in response to the gospel, let us pray.